Mr. James, Reel 7. Right, Mr. James, so we've now got you up to Scotland as part of like an advance party of Bess and Hart's men. You said there'd be an entire, there was quite a trainload of men. About how many do you think?
I would say quite a lot. I would say probably between 75 and 100 altogether, because we had a big task. We had to put up in this field marquees and bell tents and get things organised. And in addition to this sort of nucleus from the Bess and Harts, suddenly Derrymad infantrymen appeared. Mm-hmm. One of them I remember particularly was a bloke called Dave Brown, and I made a friend of him. Mm-hmm. And we went around Edinburgh looking at the sites. Mm-hmm. And he had been a branch path on there, so he filled me in about his early experience in the DLI. But he had been sent with other NCOs from the DLI as well, mm-hmm. To bolster us and to sort of create this new battalion mm-hmm. on the 16th. We worked very hard putting up the tents and waiting for the day, the big day, when the draft of civvies would be brought in from Princess Street, and it happened. Mm-hmm. They came in with their plus fours and bags, men from all over the country, not just north of England, but you know, I read that they called up men from all parts of the country. They were casualties, it wouldn't sort of all happen in Durham, for example. Mm-hmm. But you know, chaps, we were from the south of England, we were from the area, from another area. And Hampshire area, but some of the chaps called up are from Manchester and York and Nottingham and places like that, you know, and all over the place.
Can you take us through that first day? Because apparently there was three drafts arrived, but the very first day, the first draft, and what your impressions were, what you were doing.
I remember particularly they had to be kitted out, and I remember my experience as a first aid chap as well. I knew it would be quartermaster school stuff on them all, and the packing of their kit in their suitcases and the lorries taking their kit for return back to their homes. So the quartermaster's marquee was already there with all the uniforms available, and they were kitted out as they came in. Mm-hmm. They were documented, and there was another documentation tent with officers and NCOs there, seeing the only man who came in and taking his papers and so on and so forth, and recording, giving him an army number, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And eventually, we found that they were allocated bell tents, 8 men to a bell tent, mm-hmm. and they had their new uniforms on. Mm-hmm. And I felt sorry for them because they weren't coming into a depot, they were coming into a field, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the same somehow. Mm-hmm. And they were going to be trained in this location as well. Mm-hmm. And we were going to teach them. Mm-hmm. So anyway, they arrived, the numbers arrived, and then sergeants were allocated NCOs. And I was told that I was going to be with a certain Sergeant Deacon. Mm-hmm. He was the chap who'd been to Dunkirk. And he said, "You're my lance corporal, are you? Well, you and I have got a very, very tough job because we are going to, I understand, deal with the awkward ones." But anyway, he had lost his lower jaw in Dunkirk. A grenade had hit him in the mouth. Mm-hmm. And he had lost his bottom teeth. And he had scars, you know, and all that. And I was his NCO. But he was a very, very well-built chap. And serious chap. He was a soldier who was dedicated to it. He'd been to Dunkirk, but he really had no self-pity. I think he was a soldier. And the sergeants were in their tents away from the NCOs. But I had occasion to visit his tent once. This is junior NCO was given a message. And I went to the sergeant's lines. And I found that he was on his knees praying. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that he was affected by them. And he had turned to God. And he was, I would say, almost an hallucinogenic. Because at the end of the day, he would kneel down and pray, and all the other stars would throw boots at him. But he wouldn't be deterred until at the end of his prayers, you know, who threw that boot? He didn't even use swear words. But he was a marvelous dog. He turned out to be a first-class chap. And I was very pleased indeed to be with him. And he and I did a very good job.
So was he a Beds and Hearts man, or was he a dealer?
Beds and Hearts man.
Yeah.
He was a Beds and Hearts man.
Yeah.
I should never forget him. But eventually, after we did our job, you know, certain people from the 16th were sent out to the 6th, 8th, and 9th, you know. And he was one of them. And he, poor chap, was killed in Sicily on Catania Bridge as a sergeant.
Yeah, yeah. So you would be with Sergeant Deacon, and how many men would you be responsible for? How many men would you be putting through the paces?
Squads in the Bourne Hall. You know, the squads were given numbers under sergeants. And they were formed squads, and so the whole battalion numbers were there. But they were not formed into platoons yet or companies. Merely squads for the basic training. In this field, and it wasn't fair to them really, because, you know, how could you teach marching to somebody in a field where you can't hear your footsteps? You know, they had to be good to be able to sort of march to order in a field on grass. A lot of them couldn't do it because they didn't know the clip-clop of the boots. They were looking at the, you know, you couldn't do the job properly there. Until eventually, later on, of course, we got into better marching on the road.
We'll get to that, Mr. James. Yeah, but at this stage, would you be assigned to a bell tent as well?
I was in a bell tent. Yes, I was a junior NCO, and junior NCOs were all lance corporals in my bell tent.
And that would be a one NCO to how many recruits?
You know, we were accommodated. Some of the NCOs were in with the lads. But I was in.
You weren't.
I was in a bell tent with all NCOs, and we had a galvanized round bowl, one galvanized round bowl of water in the morning, for us to do our ablutions and shave and all that, and wash our private parts. You can imagine the state of that water when we'd all finished. Oh God! I often think back. It's terrible. It was really mud. But we just had the one bowl of water, and that was it.
And can you remember who, at this stage, would you be mixing? Well, obviously, you mentioned this NCO, Brown. You'd be mixing with the DLI NCOs as well.
Together. Dave Brown. Yes, Dave Brown.
So can you remember the other men that were in the bell tent with you at this stage?
No, I can't remember any of the DLI men. But I remember
the NCOs that you were mixing.
The pilot I took to was Dave Brown. He eventually served with the battalion. He was a three-inch mortar man, eventually. A three-inch mortar sergeant. He's on, he's on the picture.
On the sergeant's photograph,
And eventually, I understand, after I left the battalion in Salerno due to this year of trouble, I understand that he became the provost sergeant in Austria. There's a photograph of him Sergeant Dave Brown. He was quite a nice chap.
You told me off the tape that there was some friction between the elder DLI NCOs, the Beds and Hearts men. Could you just talk a little bit about that and how that manifested itself? And
I remember particularly there were some of the old threats of the Dunhams. Of the Beds and Hearts, there was Tubby Baker, what was that, a fag in his mouth, he was a law unto himself, he was a character, but I didn't like him very much. He was a big head, and he was, you couldn't get on with him, nobody could do it, Tubby Baker couldn't get on with him at all, didn't like him. There was Tubby Baker, there was Sergeant Stern, But as I say, A. Sergeant Brown, and I remember particularly, he was a sort of a country lad, he was, and he was telling all the lads, you know, in Morton Hall, when you go down in Edinburgh, you take advice from me. You keep it in your trousers, you know. And I remember very well making them all laugh. Yeah, you didn't bloody laugh, but you said, you thank me for telling you that, you know. And he was Sergeant Brown, I believe, a real old country chap he was. There was a PSN plumber, funny rank, I've never known any other rank to be a PSN. Mm-hmm. They were all Indian chaps. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, a lot of their Indian words wrapped off of us as well. We could all, in the end, talk, whatever they speak in India. We were chaparral, we were talking chaparral, we'd shut up. Mm-hmm. And Jildi, get a move on, hurry up. Tikai was marvellous, you know, right? Tikai, you know, and we were all speaking Indian from these desert house Indian wallows. Mm-hmm. I've been at it for so long, some of them still had sort of deep clans, you know. Mm-hmm. And one of them saying, can you imagine being in a hot bakehouse with furnaces going when it was just like that, being in India, you know, the heat was terrible. I don't think I'd like India. Yeah. But anyway, eventually, the Durham men, Arthur Pearson, for example, was a smart young chap he was, and he had his cap on fore and aft, always, he was dead serious, and he walked with purpose, and he was very smart, and he was a good soldier, disciplinarian, and everything had to be right. But Arthur Pearson joined us. But the others, or the DLI men, resented him. Because there he was, a typical Durham warrant officer, DLI warrant officer. Even when he was walking, he'd walk at 101 days a minute. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. But the others were Benton Hart's men. Mm-hmm. And they didn't like him. They thought he was a bullshitter. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I understand it. Once you had the cap badge, your Edith cap badge from your regiment, that's the Star of India and the Heart, I didn't like to lose my cap badge. Mm-hmm. I kept it for a long time.
Did you wear it at this stage?
No, but I did wear it.
Yeah.
But I kept it for a long time, thinking that perhaps I'd have to wear it again. Mm-hmm. But there came a time when I knew that I would never go back to the Desert Hearts. Mm-hmm. But the DMI badge was my badge. Mm-hmm. But I still treasured for a very long time the Desert Hearts badge. Mm-hmm. It was my initial badge. And my shoulder glasses as well. Mm-hmm.
Were there any characters, you've mentioned Dave Brown, were there any other characters in the DLI?
That
still kind of stay in your mind?
Yeah, they were. You mentioned that. I've never forgotten Ginger Argent. He was a character. There was his mate, he was a CQMF. His mate was a chap called Crow. He was another character. And they were inseparable, Ginger Argent and Crow.
Okay, where were they characters? Can you describe them?
They were like their wallop. They were CQMFs, off duty, on plane, on duty, they were on duty. But off duty, they were in the mess. They were damn good. They were clever comedians and they were very affable. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And there was another one who his name was CSM Cerino. Mm-hmm. And he was later. Mm-hmm. But he must have been a lieutenant descent, I think. But he was the Durham man as well. And he was the character. He was very, very serious. And nobody called for him at all. Not even his terrible officers. There was, you're talking about Durham characters. Miles Heatherington. Mm-hmm. I liked old Miles Heatherington very much. He came to us eventually, and he was a mature man, but he was some later. Mm-hmm. But he was a very nice, likable chap, and I liked him. I got very well with him indeed. And there was an RSM who came called RSM Pickering. Well, he was well past the cell that day. He was. Mm-hmm. He was far from the eyes. He was. He'd been an Indian man himself, I think, he was with us for quite a long while. I remember him in Norfolk with us.
Oh, we'll get onto that, Mr. James. So, this stage, you've got this draft of civilians, effectively new army men. Right. Could you take us through a typical very early days training? Obviously, you've got to learn them to march.
Yes. When yes, that's right.
And you had the awkward squad, you said.
Well, of course, they had to, first of all, go on two squads. And they were under Lencio, who had his Lance Jacks and his corporal. And the curriculum was the same as you had to learn how to march. Well, you always got the chaps, you know, who would not understand that marching is merely walking smartly. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of exaggeratingly. You've got to sort of swing your arms, sort of remember. Mm-hmm. But these chaps didn't realize that marching was just walking normally. But, you know, they would think there was something that was strange about it. And so their right arms went out to their right leg and they were the ones you would never know. Mm-hmm. And we always had a sprinkling. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And of course, they're laughable as well. But they put everybody out and you can't. Can you understand how a man can possibly walk naturally and then learn to march? Mm-hmm. They couldn't. So we had to sort of cure those chaps, mm-hmm. and they were there in large measure, thinking that marching was a difficult thing. It wasn't the same thing in the world. Mm-hmm. But the basic training, anyway, had to be done. And those squads who had the unfortunate one or two chaps who like that couldn't march. Yeah. You're not going to the awkward squad. Mm-hmm. You'll soon be back now. Mm-hmm. You're going to be away for a month or a fortnight, so you've got to be cured of your feelings. Mm-hmm. You'll be back. But to go to the awkward squad was really serious, because they just couldn't. They were keeping the platoon back. They were keeping squad back. Mm-hmm. So they came to Sergeant Deacon and me. And we had a particularly, you know, the hardest thing of all was to teach them bayonet drill. And we had to, and we're not stabbing with a bayonet at sacks, but coming up with your rifle, on guard! And you've got to come up quick on the command. Mm-hmm. You see? Parry! You know, you've got to parry a thrust made to you by a chap who's got a pole and a ring on the end of it. Mm-hmm. And a ring on the end of it, so that if you're going to go through it. Or the other side of it, which is a big blob. And if you don't parry quick enough, you've got a big blob on your nose and you've got a busted nose. So, and there's a lot of fighting. Mm-hmm. And we had to deal with all these chaps, you know, with one particular blow there. And I think we had a purpose, but we just wouldn't come up. We just wouldn't come up. He wouldn't soldier. He'd take 5 minutes to get his rifle up, and he asked him to parry, and he didn't want to do it. He didn't want to know. But he was marked for a star. When the time came, you know, to sort of use the board against him with the blood in the ring, he got the blood right in his nose. Mm-hmm. And he cried, he bled, he rubbed it all over his head, his hands, all, even a massive blood, all from the bleeding nose. Mm-hmm. And you could tell the sight. Mm-hmm. And I've never forgotten that day, this chap. I don't know what happened to him.
Can you remember his name?
You know, I think he left him a chat, and eventually he was not damn good at all. Mm-hmm. But I remember particularly that bloke in the awkward squad.
Yeah. So you had marching training. Were you starting to do firearms training at this stage when you were in the meadow?
Oh yes, that's right. Yes, firearms training. I mean, you had to drill the firearms.
Did you have real rifles at this stage for the drill? Yeah.
And the drill, and this was where the best and hardest men were at a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. They had to unlearn all their rifle drill. You didn't sort of stand with a trench with your rifle and get it up and over your shoulder and slope and, you know, and present. You had to relearn a BLI rifle drill, which was different, absolutely different. And you marched the trail with a different BLI.
That's holding the rifle
absolutely
down.
Absolutely, that's right. Mm-hmm. Right hand, marched the trail, put the balance, and you don't swing that arm. But you carry your rifle and you swing your left arm. Mm-hmm. You see? And you can, after you march the train for a long while, you sort of change arms. You know, and then you put in your left arm. But this had to be learned by the best.
Did you have trouble with that then, as it yourself?
I had no trouble at all.
Because you were a fresh young soldier, so the...
No trouble at all, because it's like, these chaps, you know, used to the arms field year after year after year, the slope and all that. I mean, I did 6 weeks of it, and all the time with my girl and my marching in bed in the ITC. I really regretted not having started in the DI from day one, because I'd done all the Bensonhurst basic training. In drill, foot drill, and arms drill. And I had to unlearn a lot, because the way the command of marching was on a different foot, and the arms drill was different. But however, I soon realized I gave myself a couple of days intense practice. At it all. I mastered it.
What about the older NCOs? Did any of those have such trouble that they were like making fools of themselves on the parade ground?
That's right. Well, I mean, everybody had to sort of, eventually you got into it, really. But, you know, when you're the ally, light infantry is entirely different from the light infantry man, and you're a special chap, really,
Some of the other veterans have talked about how, with the rifle shortage, they had to use the Canadian rifle, the P-14.
They were short at one time. They suddenly appeared. The British SMB rifle ammunition was .303. And then suddenly you've got Canadian rifles and American rifles, .30. And you just took it for granted, because it was an expansion of the army. We were really using the First World War rifles initially. They were all taken up, and we were glad to get shipments of arms from wherever. And I remember particularly those new rifles coming on the scene. Thankfully, I passed that stage. I didn't have to instruct them into anything, but I saw them.
Yeah. So, in terms of the recruits that you had in Scotland, would they be on basically the same 6 weeks, effectively the same 6 weeks that you went through in the Bensonhurst, or a light infantry version of that?
Absolutely. The curriculum was the same. You had to go through the basic training, you had to learn to be a soldier, to wear the uniform, to be clean, polished, spit and polish, to march, to know the drill, soldierly bearing, and to learn food, power, and shooting.
So at the end of 6 weeks, you would effectively have what would be, soldiers in effect, young,
At the end of 6 weeks, so I what happened then? The first lieutenant colonel was a lieutenant colonel Morrow Bernard, M-O-R-R-O-G-H-Bernard, Morrow Bernard. He was our first lieutenant colonel. Now, he, I understand, was also the instigator of the formation of the 16th Guards. He died not long ago, and I read his obituary, and it said in there that it all down that it was his idea to form the 16th Battalion of the DLI. He became the first lieutenant colonel of it. He was a very smart chap with a big hat and moustache, Indian Army Poona Waller, walking about with a shooting stick, with a lovely leather seat that he could sort of stick in the grass and put his bottom on this stuff. And there you'd see him very often visiting the platoons, sitting on his shooting stick. And I'd never seen that ever before. He was a real Poona bloke. Suddenly, he'd gone. And I read about it. Do you know where he went? He went to regain Abyssinia for Haile Selassie. He was sent out to be in charge of the British task force against the Italians. Then we had in his...
That's moving us forward to further than what I got at the moment.
He was there, under his supervision anyway.
What about... so he was obviously taking a close interest in how his recruits were being trained. So, because you have strong memories of him. Do you have memories of any of the other officers at this stage and what they might be doing? Would there be lieutenants and people of that
rank? The officers and the company commanders, of course, have yet to be allocated. We didn't have anybody. I can't remember I can't remember, in Morton Hall.
So at this stage it was effectively an NCO-run battalion.
It was, that's right, under Mortimer Bernard, and he must have had his officers, but there were certain officers who eventually came from Durham, from the Battle of George, for example, and Major Barnes. I remember him arriving. The officers in the early days, apart from the Lieutenant Girling, who was the signals officer, he was a second lieutenant at the time, but then he was made up eventually lieutenant to be the signals officer. He worked with me.
Yeah.
I was sent to him. So my early recollections were of only officers up to the rank of second lieutenant and lieutenant. And Girling is one that sticks out in my mind.
And was he there right in the early days?
Yes, he was.
Yeah,
he
was.
And he was a very nice, he was very young. Pale blue eyes, piercing blue eyes, and a generous mouth. And I remember particularly having some Girling. I don't think he belonged to Girling's grade, but he was a very smart chap and a very affable chap. He was nothing but smiles. And I was eventually landed with him. He either picked me or else we came together, but we hit it off like a house on fire from the very beginning of the call, very well, because I didn't realise at the time that he was going to be the signals officer either. But I suppose, really speaking, it was engine there, because eventually the time came to say goodbye to squads and to form platoons.
And when do you think that would be, Mr. James?
Oh, that was a very early time.
Possibly just after the first 6 weeks.
Eventually we left Morton Hall, and I tried to pick up the next station. What happened was, I remember particularly now, we were still in squads at Dunfermline, and Harry Stern was training the chaps in the street. Sergeant Stern, he took over in Dunfermline, we took over a carpet factory. Dunfermline's all hills. And I remember going down this very steep hill, down to a dead end, and there was a carpet factory empty, and that was our billet. And Harry Stern, Sergeant Stern of the Gates of France, was drilling the men on the road. Now, to hear, I remember this was the first time, where they could hear their feet on the metallic roadway, you know, and again, oh, clump, 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 with the marching soldiers, you know.
Had you managed to, just to interrupt you there, had you managed to learn the men how to march by this stage on the meadow? Because we talked off the tape about how it was virtually impossible.
That's right, but they were still in shambles because you couldn't hear your feet. On the meadowland, on the grassland, they were better at it by looking at the chap in front. And if they were out of step, they were told and corrected by the NCOs, especially by the junior NCOs, who were marching at the side and saying, out of step, change step. All you've got to do is watch the chap in front of you. You can't go wrong. And then they call out, and on the left, you put the left foot going down. And so you would eventually get better and better. But it was, you know, it wasn't ideal.